Hi there. You're listening to a special release of Radio Bartman today. For the first time, we're releasing full audio from our most recent interview. David Weinberger's interview with Stephen Wolfram, the founder of the computational knowledge engine Wolfram Alpha, will still appear as its own episode next week, but for now you can listen to the full 55-minute interview. Enjoy! What is Wolfram Alpha? So, our kind of best three-word description is it's a computational knowledge engine. So its purpose is to take the knowledge that has been accumulated over the course of years, and those parts of it that can be computed with, to be able to compute with them and to be able to generate answers to specific questions using the sort of corpus of existing knowledge, using the data, the methods, the models, and so on that have been accumulated, put them in computational form and be able to answer sort of any specific question where the answer can be computed. What are prototypical questions that you have in mind for this? So, there can be sort of pure formal questions that are like mathematical questions, like what's the integral of this or that. There can be questions about the world, like, you know, what's the population of such and such a country, what was the weather like on a particular day in a particular place. There can be things that sort of combine some pure data with computation, like, for example, you know, what will the tide be on a particular day at a particular place, where you have to know some geographical data, some historical information about tides, and then you have to compute the physics of the tides to work out what will happen. And there are things which are both, where the answers are both numbers and quantitative kinds of things, and where the answers are more kind of textual or symbolic. The answers that the site gives are not simple one-word answers or numbers. They give that too, but you are including a range of types of information that somebody might want. Right, so the idea is, what would an expert do if you asked them this question? What would they actually tell you? Would they just tell you one answer? Would they give you kind of some background? Would they give you some related answers? Kind of the idea is to generate a report it sort of gives you both, it gives you sort of all versions of what you might immediately want to know about a particular thing. So that will be typically some graphical presentations, some tables of data, some synthesized text, these kinds of things. It's sort of a big challenge is to sort of do this kind of automated presentation where you try and take out of, in some cases there might be a huge amount of stuff that you could compute. Problem is to sort of pick out those things that will be most kind of immediately cognitively useful to the person who asked that question. In the demonstration that I've seen, not a lot of the answer text or the answers that are given are links out, or links to more information, in fact. Is that on purpose, or is that to come? Well, so, it's hard enough to get kind of within one kind of coherent system to sort of build up the things that we think are worth presenting to people, so to speak, without having to worry about whether some external link goes to something that's meaningful or not. Generally, what we're trying to do is to try and have this be kind of, this is giving you kind of the report that you want. There is some drill down that you can have, which might be an infinite amount of drill down that's possible from. So for example, a typical thing would be there's some table of results, and then there's a little button that says more. You press more, you press it once, you get more stuff, you press it again, you get even more stuff, you can keep pressing it sometimes forever. That's kind of the main way to kind of get more information is something sort of within this controlled environment that we've set up. Now, we also have a few links out, but we also have a sidebar where we intend to put sort of related links to things that people might find useful given the particular questions that they're asking. And often those links will be to things that are complementary to the kind of sort of direct factual material that we're giving. Things that, for example, are linking out to, I don't know, Wikipedia or something, where there's some narrative description of some particular topic, and it kind of complements the just the facts kind of results that we're giving them off and off. There aren't also a lot of links internally to more of your own results. And so, again, just seeing a demonstration, I haven't played with it, and the site is not live yet. The visual sense seems to be you've got your answer. It's a rich answer, there's lots there, but this is the definitive end point of your inquiry. As opposed to having internal links that would say, here's the answer, and please explore more, click on, and get more of our rights. So the more thing, there really is a pretty, pretty elaborate world underneath all these more buttons and so on. There's really a lot to explore there. If it's a question of go off and ask another related question, or a question about some entity that happened to come up here, then yes, there's a pop-up that comes up, and there are links in that pop-up that you can go and make queries about the entities that appear. I would say there's probably more that could be developed about that, about the way that those pop-ups work and the way that one kind of goes to explore more things. Our big emphasis has been, once we're in an area where we can actually compute things, we can often compute a lot of stuff. And, you know, the big issue is what's actually useful to show somebody sort of at the first level. And it's often kind of for the people who've been developing all these wonderful computations, it's sometimes a little disappointing when I say, look, we can only put, you know, 10 results here on the first thing that people see, and the rest has to be based on drill down, because, you know, it's not useful to give 50 things on one page. Nobody's going to be able to pick out the thing that's actually useful to them. But so there's a pretty rich world of sort of additional stuff that you can get to just by pressing buttons and pulling down pull-downs for alternate views of things and so on. So how does it work? I mean, it's pretty impressive. Yeah, I mean, so you know, there are a sort of two key kind of foundations that make Wolfram Alpha possible, and then there are a variety of different sort of pieces of technology that have to be assembled to create the experience that we're setting up. So in terms of sort of the foundations, you know, one of them is Mathematica, and the other is my MKS new kind of science direction. Mathematica is sort of the underlying infrastructure, the language, the platform on which the site is built. I've been working on developing Mathematica for 23 years, so it's a big thing that's had had sort of a lot of development and has had a nice sort of accelerating pace of development in recent years, particularly as sort of all the pieces that we've assembled over the years that really sort of fit together according to the principles we've laid down, sort of seem to be interacting in a nice way that lets the system sort of grow very rapidly. So kind of the one important sort of answer to how does it work is it's a big mathematical program. It's quite big. It's 5 or 6 million lines of Mathematica code. And Mathematica, in most measurements one can make, is perhaps 10, maybe 20 times more succinct as a programming language than a typical kind of, you know, C, Java type programming language. So that's a lot of code, but if one was doing it without the Mathematica platform, I think it is not a manageable kind of project to be doing at this point. So Mathematica enables you to do mathematical computation, but also symbolic, logical computation as well. Right. Well, I mean, the perhaps the biggest Mathematica was such a great name for Mathematica when Mathematica was young, and it's and the thing that one needed to sort of know about what it did was it does mathematics on a computer. In a sense, it's been, I'd sort of hoped that the field of mathematics would have grown up to the point where the kinds of things that Mathematica does are actually considered mathematics. It's in a sense, it's a misnomer and has been for a very long time, because Mathematica has grown far beyond sort of the doing of mathematics. It's really a general environment for doing sort of anything that is formal and technical and so on. It's been kind of a place where we can fit together sort of all the algorithms that exist for practically anything. And we've sort of maintained these kind of unifying principles for the system that have been just wonderful in terms of developing new capabilities, because it means, you know, we're adding something that's supposed to be some kind of numerical process for working out such and such a thing. But because we have this kind of very unified system, we're able in the innards of that numerical thing to be calling on all sorts of, you know, computational geometry or some other, you know, kind of, algebraic algorithm or anything like this. So it's really, it's Mathematica itself kind of outgrew the bounds of its name a long time ago. What's happened with Wolfen Alpha, one of the things that people used to say, this Mathematica thing is obviously really powerful, and lots of people around the world, lots of sort of leaders in R&D, and lots of places, lots of sort of people being educated, people doing the education, they use Mathematica a lot. But people said, you know, this is really a powerful thing. You really should be able to, you know, why are you even selling it to people? I mean, why don't you just keep it for yourself and you know, build something great with it? This is, you know, Wolfen Alpha is probably the largest project. It's the largest project that's been done with Mathematica. I don't necessarily know everything that everybody has done all around the world with Mathematica, but what Mathematica provides for us is kind of a uniform way of representing knowledge in symbolic form and applying, and we already have in Mathematica a zillion algorithms for operating on that kind of symbolic representation, whether it's in a kind of purely mathematical way, whether it's in a sort of proving theorems in some logical way, whether it's representing things graphically in some way, these kinds of things. So that's kind of the technical platform that makes Wolfen Alpha, I think, conceivable. From a conceptual point of view, I think it's sort of the NKS new kind of science thing that makes Wolfen Alpha kind of conceivable. I mean, I've kind of wondered, you know, Wolfen Alpha is kind of the third big project I've tried to do in my life, Mathematica and NKS. The other two, I kind of have this meta theory that most people have at most one big idea in their lives, right? So if I've got three big projects, they're really all the same idea. And they're really all about kind of taking a sort of a rich set of things that one is interested in dealing with and understanding what are the sort of underlying primitives from which one can build up all those things. Whether it's in the computer language of Mathematica, having the sort of computational primitives that let one build up programs, whether it's in the case of NKS, asking if we look at the world, the universe as it is, what are the kind of underlying primitives, what are the computational, the simple programs that can potentially drive all of this stuff? And Wolfram Alfred said of the realization that all this knowledge that's out there in the world, that there is a feasibly small sort of set of frameworks and algorithms and computations from which one can sort of move out to deal with all these different kinds of things. But for me, kind of the paradigm of MKS, which is sort of this idea that there really are, for the world at large, these kind of small programs that are capable of being rich enough in their behavior to sort of capture a lot of what goes on in the world. The idea that there are these small programs is the thing that sort of, from a paradigmatic point of view, makes it to me conceivable that one can do something like Wolfram Alfred that isn't just too big. And, you know, that one doesn't just have to say, you know, and sort of the traditional kind of science, one might say, it's just too big. The only way to do this is to have a billion people work on it. There just can't be sort of underlying, sort of fairly small programmatic principles that let one build this kind of thing up. So that, for me at least in my current, I've noticed that when I do these projects, it takes me about a decade to actually realize what the real point of what I did was. Sometimes other people point it out to me in much less time than that, but as I say, my meta theory is people have at most one big idea, so all these things are connected, and exactly how kind of MKS, the paradigm of MKS flows into Wolfram Alpha. I know some part of it. There's probably more to that flow than I yet know. I've been very interested in the relation of MKS, of new kind of science, and Wolfram Alpha. Can you give an example, maybe, of where MKS thinking shows up in the development of? Right, so as I mean, for example, in a very straightforward thing is the linguistic analysis of inputs. Right, so we have, it might seem that it's just too messy, too complicated, there's too many possibilities. The fact is that what we end up with are these fairly small, simple rules that we often deduce from looking at some giant corpus of information from the web and giant collection of ways that people say things. We try and abstract these fairly simple rules. And then we have to ask ourselves, you know, so what consequences do these rules have? And, you know, if you look at the folks who are developing the linguistic analysis parts of Wolfram Alpha, for some strange reason, almost all the senior people Wolfian Linguistic Analysis for Wolfram Alpha. I've worked on MKS. This is a strange coincidence. Maybe it isn't such a coincidence, because when you actually look at, work that's being done, there are these images, these graphics that show up on the screen that look awfully like kind of evolution of cellular automata or some such other thing. There are all these blobs of color and so on that represent, in this case, various pieces of potential linguistic analysis for phrases or whatever else it is. But it's very much a sort of an MKS approach of you take these fairly small underlying programs and you say, what did this build up into? And does this successfully manage to correspond to something that is useful for sort of doing linguistic analysis? I mean, in general, in developing Wolfram Alpha, and actually also a lot in developing Mathematica these days, the algorithms that we have were not engineered by people. They're things that were essentially found in the computational universe of possible algorithms. And it's kind of like, I view it as being kind of like an algorithmic version of mining. I mean, when we deal with sort of standard engineering technology, we're used to going out into the world and going and finding, the iron ore and, putting it together and making something, making a steel thing out of it or something like that. Now, what MKS sort of suggests is that out in the computational universe of possible programs, there's lots of interesting, quite small programs that exist. And the question is, can we go as humans and find programs that are useful to mine from that collection of possible programs, that are useful to mine for the particular technological purposes that we have? And that's something we've ended up doing a lot of. I mean, a lot of the pieces of code that exist in Mathematica in Wolfram Alpha are things that were sort of just found in the computational universe and turn out to be really useful, in the same way that people, found that, magnetite is really useful, liquid crystals are really useful in the material world. It's not clear to me how you're using MKS in the natural language processing. MKS in the NLP. It looked like, just on the surface of the sorts of queries that you were entering when you were giving your examples, it looked like you were doing that what was happening was the normal thing for this sort of query managing, that there are stop words that you take out because they're not interesting words, and there were some humans that you refer to fluff in your discussions, sort of fluff words that you take out that aren't necessary. And what you end up with is a set of some core words where you can induce or deduce a relationship. And one of the examples was a query was MSFT, Microsoft's stock symbol, Sun. In which case we got back interesting data about both of those companies. And so somewhere from Alpha decided that with a stock symbol like MSFT, which it noticed presumably has some database of stock symbols, that therefore it's a pretty good assumption that Sun doesn't refer to the solar entity but to another company. That's what I sort of thought was going on, based on nothing. Is there an NKS piece of that that is doing the parsing, or I think in that particular case, let's see what's going on in that particular case. Well, if that's not a case for the NKS supplies, then right. Take one more. I've got to do more work on this because it's funny, you know, when I talk to the folks who are working on linguistic analysis for OpenAlpha, if you ask them, they'll say, well, yes, we know lots about NKS. We worked on NKS for a bunch of years, but before working with Alpha, they say, well, okay, how are you using NKS in this? And they'll say, they'll kind of scratch their heads and they'll say, well, I'm not completely sure. And then, you know, I'll ask them, okay, well, how does this or that work? And they'll start explaining, well, this is a simple algorithm, we run it, produces all this stuff, and then you look at the pictures that are, sitting on their screens and so on, and say, this is awfully like kind of the NKS paradigm of small program, trying to figure out what it does, trying to see in this particular case whether what it does is useful for a particular purpose. I think we're going to have to come up with much sort of more slam dunk examples of, this is a case where the way that this particular piece of parsing is done is sort of a pure NKS play, but what's kind of going on, in general, with parsing of inputs, there are certain rules, sometimes they're as simple as templates, sometimes they're more grammatical kinds of things that are more like sort of the structure of mathematical expressions or of some you know, human language expressions, and sort of the point is there are these sort of small fragments of program that are sort of being applied over and over again and producing kind of the richness of interpretation that we end up actually seeing in interpreting language. But we need some better standard examples. So we have Mathematica, we've got NKS, and there are other, obviously, other components to Wolfram Alpha. There's data, for example. Right, so I think the way I see the system from a sort of technology point of view, there are really kind of four pillars of the technology that we built. The first of them is kind of curated data. So, you know, we've got a lot of data that we've organized, correlated, cleaned up, made computable, not just static data, but also data that's kind of flowing in from all sorts of feeds and all this kind of thing. We've kind of built this sort of industrial pipeline for curating data where, you know, we put a lot of effort into identifying the right sources, we get the data in, we have a lot of automation and kind of trying to find correlations, anomalies and so on in the data. Then we feed it to actual sort of human data curators, and we sort of expose it to domain experts, because one thing I've discovered is that if there isn't a domain expert somewhere in the pipeline, you're going to get the wrong answer. The goal is to take sort of raw data from the outside and get it to the point where it's really consistent and computable with. So that's kind of the first component, is kind of this curated data component. Another component is the computational algorithms that go inside. You know, there's the question of taking the fruits of science and engineering and, you know, all sorts of forms of analysis and encoding them in a computational form so that we can actually use them when people need to use them, apply them to the data that we have, and so on. And that's been a big effort of kind of just seeing just what is science and so on achieved, and how do we make it computational. And it's just big Mathematica programs, 5 or 6 million lines of Mathematica code now, that encode sort of the things that one can compute about the world based on science and so on. So that's kind of the second component of Wolfram Alpha. The third component is sort of the linguistic analysis component of how do we take these funny utterances that humans will feed to Wolf Malfa and try and understand what can we compute from that. And in a sense, that was a part of it. I mean, every part of this project seemed to me like it might be impossible. This is one of the ones where I had sort of an argument from history that this part would be impossible, which is that people have been trying to do natural language understanding for a really long time, and its successes are not that widespread. But what I realized at some key moment was what we're trying to do is kind of the opposite of what people have mostly been trying to do. What people have mostly been trying to do is they were throwing thousands or millions of pages of sort of perfectly formed text. Linguistic texts, and they ask their computers, okay, go understand all this narrative, go read these books and tell me what they're about, kind of thing. Computers have found it really hard to do that. Our problem is kind of the opposite. There's a certain set of things that we know how to compute things with, and that we represent in a sort of symbolic form. And if we can figure out, if we can get something that is in that symbolic form, then we're off and running. So really the question is, can we take these sort of human utterances and map them to these symbolic forms that we happen to know about, and then we can go off and actually do our thing and compute things with them. So it's sort of the opposite from the traditional natural language understanding problem, and it's something where I was not sure whether we would sort of be squashed by the ambiguities and vicissitudes of language. It's turned out to be surprisingly that all these different notations and pieces of kind of compact representation that people use as specialists in particular areas don't overlap as much as I thought they did. And kind of a good test now, sometimes we'll see these things which we can't deal with, and I'll show them to a bunch of people, and no person will be able to figure out what on earth this was about. And one of the things we realize is, you know, there may be some perfect kind of almost mathematical theory of how language should be specified, but it sort of can't work, because as we're putting on all these different kinds of specialist notations, if every one was arbitrarily extended in a perfect way, they will inevitably collide with each other. And so we only get to, you know, if we can just do the part that humans can understand, that's really what we need to do, because it's going to be humans who are going to be entering in in this sort of, at least this interface to Wolf Malfoy, it's humans who are doing the entering of things. So anyway, the sort of third component is this linguistic analysis component and being able to deal with kind of free-form linguistic input. Fourth component is really how you present the results, because sometimes there's just a zillion things you can compute about something, and there's the question of which actual results do we present so that it is kind of cognitively useful to the human who's reading it. And there's sort of a collection of expert knowledge, heuristics, algorithms, a sort of thing that we call computational aesthetics, which is a kind of the question of, you know, when you're going to present some piece of data in graphical form, what's the kind of way to do that that is most likely to be accessible to a person. So this is kind of the fourth component, is this kind of automated presentation component that is important. And you know, one of the things I realized about the system as we built it is you know, we couldn't really shirk on any one of these four things. We can't, we need a lot of actual curated data. Otherwise, there's no kind of raw material to do anything with. We need to be able to compute with it. It's no good to just say, look up the data, because the chance that somebody just wants to look up the particular thing that you put in is not going to be very great. We need to actually be able to compute from that. We need to have a way for people to interact with the system. You know, we need to be able to, we're not kind of expecting to read the Mathematica documentation now. Even just for Mathematica, it's 10,000 pages. For Wolf Malfoy, we're not going to expect people to read the whole encyclopedia in order to be able to interact with us. So sort of the only choice is to have a zero documentation approach, where we're just dealing with sort of pure sort of language as people will produce it. And then finally, the presentation of information, we can generate all sorts of wonderful stuff, but if we can't present in the form that people can absorb, it's also not useful. So we kind of need all these four components to actually build a system that that can be useful. You can actually take one of the components, the data component, and if you wanted to split it in two, there's a component of that could conceivably be counted as important, which is metadata, the decision about which information about the information you're going to capture. This metadata, which at least least much of it is apparently in the form of ontologies of connected concepts, may have its own value.
Right. Well, I mean, I think...
And its own limitations, by the way, right?
Right.
I mean, we didn't think of the sort of the assembly of data into Wolf-Malfa as being an exercise in ontology. We really thought of it as just, let's figure out how we compute things in all these different domains. Obviously, we're educated folk, so we know about kind of the idea of ontologies and the various efforts people have made to sort of do semantic web kinds of things with ontologies, these kinds of things, right? When you're going to describe a kind of thing, there's a question of sort of what are the pieces of that description? If you're going to describe, I don't know, you have some entity,
say a cousin.
Right. So you have, you know, there's the notion of a country, there's the notion of a country has certain properties, there's certain attributes, like what date were you talking about this country, at? There's questions about, are there groups of countries that are kind of, classes that from which, countries in NATO or something like that, or countries in South America. These are all kind of part of this sort of ontological structure of the knowledge about countries. And for us, we have a pretty definite representation of that kind of knowledge about countries. We need that because otherwise we can't have it sort of operate with other kinds of information. We need to be able to have, this is part of making Wolf-Malfa sort of a manageable thing, is that there are kind of global frameworks that operate across a bunch of different domains. And for that, we need sort of an organized ontology of things. Now, there are some tricks of kind of... One of the big challenges with ontologies is you have an ontology about countries. How does it relate to the ontology about cities? How does it relate to the ontology about this, that, and the other, right? So, we were approaching this from a very kind of practical engineering point of view. We're just building ontologies across hundreds of domains. But we realized that there were important ways to have these ontologies communicate with each other, that one of them was actually a very sort of science-oriented way, which is units of measure of things. So there's all physical quantities that things represent. So, for instance, if you have
two things that both have units of volume. There's a reasonable chance that these things are somehow related to each other. Not always. You know, there can be a thing where I'm not sure I can generate it for length cubed in particular, but it's quite commonly the case that for something which has sort of the same physical dimensions, there may be three or four different kinds of concepts that that relates to. And so, for example, a length could be a depth, it could be an altitude, it could be a height. These are related concepts, and often they can be dealt with in a sort of in an interoperable kind of way. You can divide two of these things and it's meaningful. You can perhaps add them and it's meaningful. But then there are some other kinds of purposes for which you can't combine them, and for which you might want to give some different related information and so on. So it gets quite subtle, but we have kind of a reasonable, pragmatic way, at least, to deal with things like, properties that that are related and that can be combined in particular ways, these types of things. I mean, I think that I would love it to be the case because, I'm kind of a theoretical scientist by life pursuit, so to speak. You know, it'd be great if there was just a grand theory of all this stuff, if we could just start from scratch as a, as one of the sort of philosophers of old, whether it was, from the Rogers to the Mortimer Adlers to the whatever, whoever wanted to organize knowledge in a very sort of structured way, and just sort of say, top down, let's just describe the ontology of the world, and let's just then build a system based on the ontology of the world that we've thereby described. I don't expect that isn't what we did, and despite my great predilection for grand theories of things, that seems really hard and in some sense not useful, because what we're dealing with is sort of human accessible knowledge. And here I might get a little philosophical on things, but there's sort of the question of what knowledge is possible and what knowledge is kind of human related. So for instance, from MKS we've learnt that sort of in the computational universe of possible programs, there's lots of stuff out there. We as humans have only explored some tiny corners of this, for example in our mathematics. It is the case that particular mathematics that we've pursued has grown from some particular axiom systems and so on. But we could just say, let's throw it open, let's look at the space of all possible axiom systems. You know, gazillions of possible axiom systems, of which the mathematics that we've pursued is only 10 of them, for example. But there are gazillions of others. And they all have their properties and they all have particular features. The stuff that is sort of human, has humanly been accessed is only this tiny corner, these 10 axiom systems that we kind of grandfathered through from the Babylonians on. What happens when we look at all the other ones? What happens if all this knowledge that hasn't been sort of humanly accessed knowledge? Well, one of the things that I learned from Mancaeus is a lot of it is knowledge you just can't get in any kind of quick way. That is, you go right into computational irreducibility and undecidability and so on. There's lots that you can't compute about the world. There's a certain amount that you can compute that is sort of the parts that have formed the science that we've developed in traditionally as humans, the mathematics we've developed, things like that. There's also a lot out there that is not accessible in that way. Now the other thing that is the case is, so one problem is, you can't compute it. There's, you know, if you fall off the parts that are, in the language of Mancaeus, computationally reducible, the parts for which kind of theoretical science works well, if you fall off those parts, and there's a lot away from those parts, you just can't compute that much. You kind of just have to follow simulations to see what will happen and things you can't quickly work out what will happen. Okay, there's a second problem, which is you can't linguistically describe what you're talking about. As humans, we've developed a certain language. The concepts that we've put into our language are the concepts that we have done a lot with, that we sort of become familiar with. Those are the things that we tend to give words to. And one of the other limitations, in a sense, is sort of at a philosophical level, a limitation is that even after its interface is linguistic. The things that one can easily describe to it are things for which there is human language. There's a lot else out there for which that is sort of both very hard to compute with, and for which there isn't sort of a human linguistic representation that That's convenient. I mean, when you see a picture of a cellular automaton evolution and somebody says, quick, describe it, you know, we don't have words to describe these things. It's a long, you know, you'd be writing, you'd basically eventually just be saying, well, just look at the picture, you know, you see what it looks like.
That's what it's from.
I mean, so, you know, I think that, in some sense, in one of my sort of philosophical comments about Wolfram Alpha is this idea of computational irreducibility, the idea that there's lots of sophisticated computation that goes on in the world and nature that makes some of the complexity of nature. It's the flip side of that fact that makes Wolfram Alpha possible, by which I mean that there's, in a sense, comparatively little about which we can talk linguistically or which we can about which we can compute. In the space of all possible things, there's only this so small corner. And that means that when we get to sort of linguistically talk about things, because there's only this small corner we can talk about, it is feasible to actually understand this broad range of language because it can only talk about the small corner of things. If we were able to talk about everything, it would be much harder to understand with a short description what we could possibly be talking about. I'm sorry, this is getting very on the philosophical end of things.
So I want to ask about, within that small corner of things that we can talk about, a possible limitation, back on the metadata side. Many have pointed out, metadata is politics, and decision about what counts, what's interesting to us and ought to be tracked about, say, a country or any other entity is itself a reflection of a cultural and possibly political interests. So, if I were to ask Wolfram Alpha a question that I think it's not designed for, such as, how many people in the U.S. have been tortured? Or, give me a list of world religions. Which is a very straightforward sort of question. That one's, the first question obviously is politically loaded. The second one is very straightforward sort of question. Will Scientology show up on it?
It's a good question. And
more important, what's the decision process?
Right.
So what do you do with that?
Right.
Inevitable decision.
So, I mean, you know, what we're trying to do, so, in this phase of the project, what we've done is to take sort of generally reliable public sources of data, so to speak, and try and make them computable. We're
saying, you know, what do you think of, you know, what is your religion or something like that. So, you know, this question in the case of, for example, religions, we've been agonizing about this particular one, and there was a big push on the part of some people on the project that we just shouldn't put this in, because it's too much of a mess, right? But then other people pointed out, look, it's more useful to have something than to have nothing. I mean, it is useful to know, you know, roughly how many, you know, Christians are there in the world or something, or are there in, you know, in South America or something like that. That's useful information. Now, even if it's slightly wrong, because there might be different definitions, and, you know, do you count, you know, how many animists are there in America or something, right? You know, there might be different definitions of that. You know, I sometimes think that after my work on NKS that I should count myself as an animist, but that's a separate discussion.
There's a headline for you.
Becomes animist. Right. That's our decision procedure is probably similar to the decision procedure of folks who've tried to put together encyclopedias or any other kind of authoritative reference work. You know, we try and do the best we can, we talk to experts. In our case, we get, you know, we have a couple of constraints. We want to have something. Eventually, we're going to want to have a definite number for something. Even though we may annotate it with a footnote, at some level, we're going to have to make a decision. There is a definite number for this thing. So, in the case of, in the case of religions, you know, you can look, I don't know, the CIA fact book will have, you know, something, some data on that. There are particular organizations that collect data on that kind of thing. I don't know in the particular case of that example, I know that something we're actually actively trying to unscramble right now. With luck, those different sources will vaguely, at least close to agree, at least to the first or second decimal place they'll agree. You know, the first or second significant figure will agree. Let me give you a different sort of example, because, for example, if I asked for a list of broadband penetration by nation, this is hotly contested. What constitutes broadband? The FCC has had one way of counting broadband that is extremely generous and people will use these numbers from your site to the extent to which your site becomes the place where you go to get the answer that the experts would have given you. The extent to which it succeeds is going to be used in these debates. Does it concern you that some of the answers, at least, are in fact based upon good decisions, but decisions nonetheless about what constitutes good data and how to categorize that data? Right, so we sort of have three escape valves for this issue. Okay? The first thing is you type your input and we'll typically give what we call the input interpretation. The first part of output will be the input interpretation. Okay? So if you say something like, you know, how much do school teachers get paid? Right? It's a complicated question, right? The input interpretation will probably say, you know, I don't know what, school teachers, including this and that, and the other excluding this, median wage. Okay? So, we're saying what question we're actually answering. That might be, we hope, as close to any useful variant of the question you asked. But it may not be, you know, you will have asked some question where you might have had something different in mind. You might have had the minimum wage or the maximum wage or something else. Now, typically in our sort of report that we generate, we will give what we know about, you know, the range of wages or some such other thing. But when we have to compute from it, if you say, you know, how much do teachers get paid divided by doctors? Okay? You know, by the time you're doing that, you've, we'll give a definite answer for the ratio of the median wages, and then we may give a bunch of additional information about, sort of, the data that went into it. So the first, in a sense, escape valve, first place where we get to sort of put things through a more precise filter is we have this input interpretation that says this is what we're actually dealing with. Okay? So another thing is that when we give answers, we try to give kind of pithy footnotes that give an indication of what it is we're actually assuming. I mean, a typical example is, I don't know, some health kind of thing, where, you know, there'll be a classification for your overweight, for instance, okay? Now, that's, to many people, that's a valid judgment, right? To some other people, it's a precise medical distinction, right? What we're dealing with is more the precise medical distinction than the valid judgment. And so,
we'll put a little, try to make a pithy footnote, because we know people, if we put a giant essay there, nobody's going to read it. It sort of says, I don't remember that particular one, but it'll say, based on, CDC or WHO, guidelines or some such other thing. So that's kind of the, that's how we try to deal with these things, where there's a distinction that's been made, and it's sort of, we try to go with whatever the standards body has said, and then say what the standards body is. And then the final thing that we get to do is, we sometimes get to put up a thing saying, assuming you mean blah, then we give a bunch of results, and use blah instead, right? And so that's another place where we get to, if people have, if there's sort of a very controversial thing is, actually one that came up recently that was a slightly different issue, but there's questions about, do you assume this country is part of that country, things like that, where we can assume both cases. There are these funny cases where we just had one recently that was sort of horrifying, was pets versus food problem. So, the issue is, if you type in rabbit, what do you get? Okay? And for reasons of bad sort of linguistic prioritization, one was getting nutrition content, right? And what one realizes is that in the U.S.
That's a great example.
In the U.S. this is very upsetting to people, right? And in other countries, it's a different story. So that's a case where we get to use GIP information, and we will make the decision in the U.S. a rabbit is an animal with these characteristics. I don't know in the case of rabbits in particular, but let's assume that they're a very popular food in some other country and not usually kept as pets there. Then the GYP in that country will cause us to flip around that assumption. How open is this site? It's open to everybody to use, it's a free site, but the data and the metadata and the algorithms seem to be quite valuable. Other people could make use of it. What are the plans for making this and for opening this site up? Also, the first thing is that there's going to be an API for people to make kind of different levels of different sort of kinds of access to the site. So another computer program can call yours and get results back. Right, or it could be another website that is including some pods of output from FMF on that site, providing some input field with some specialized input field that can go and use the FMF engine and get results back. Or it could be some, you know, desktop application program that is making calls to FMF. The thing that one realizes is, you know, it's a living, breathing thing. It's not very easy to take pieces of it and just say to people, you know, here's a big piece, you know, go do something useful with it. Because, for example, let's take the data. The data changes, you know, all the time. The data is changing. It's changing. Some data is changing very rapidly on timescales of 1 second. Some data is changing on timescales of 1 month. It's not the case. We can't just say sort of dump the data out, because the data is really just the seed for, in many cases, the data is the seed for an algorithm. It's also frequently data that is proprietary and it's licensed. Yes, that's right. I think that the idea is that we will provide a resource that for anybody who wants to use what we have, we will provide a good way for them as humans to use it, as humans using programs to have their programs use it. And sort of the idea is to provide an efficient, you know, well-kept up kind of sort of an industrially strong kind of thing that people can go to get what they need from this. Now, you know, we certainly are aware of the fact that there are computations that the people we want to do that will run longer than the site could possibly run them for. The good news is that we have a great sort of vehicle for running those computations, and that's Mathematica. The issue is, and Mathematica has for 20 years, Mathematica has very happily run on millions of actual computers around the world, on people's desktops. One of the things that I think we'll see happening is that there'll be things where the sort of the Wolfram Alpha kind of central store of data, sort of computational elements and so on. And then there's the sort of the thick client for it, which is the Mathematica, that's able to take sort of pieces of what's coming from OpenAlpha and run that stuff locally. So this is sort of a way of again sort of opening out and enabling more people to kind of get access to sort of the capabilities that we're providing. The ontologies or schema or whatever you want to call them, those themselves, the fact that you have a way of representing, say, a nation and multiple other domains, that's something that people working on the semantic web are working quite hard at doing. Is that, you're going to make that available as well? Probably. I mean, I think that will. So, one thing we hope to do is to have a nice, organized, almost formalized process for people to contribute data to our data repository. And in order to make that possible, we kind of have to say, how is this data going to be structured? And so, you know, I think we'll probably have quite an effort in, for particular domains, in sort of exposing some of the structure that we've already built. And possibly people will propose other pieces of structure that need to get added on to that. So I think that will get exposed, and you know, if there's good traffic and data being provided for sort of access by people in OpenAlpha, if there's good traffic to that, I suspect that the ontology that we have will sort of become kind of a useful standard for other people who are kind of doing things with where they're trying to sort of fit semantic data together. A useful free standard, a useful open standard. Yeah, those do. I'm not sure I've thought through all of these. My guess is that we will want it to be an open standard because from our point of view, the more data that exists in the world that is structured in a way that, particularly a way that we can easily deal with, the better everybody is, and the better we are too. I mean, in a sense, what we, our objective is to make, you know, this good sort of definitive sort of place to go to get computational knowledge. And there are many components to that. I mean, the data is just one component. If more of the world would help in assembling the data, that would be great. I mean, so far, I have to say that our, I mean, units, we hire lots of data curators, right? And they do a great job. But we hope that there will be quite a community of sort of volunteer data curators, and we'll provide sort of tools for volunteer data curators. But I'm a little bit less, I'll be very interested to see what happens. I mean, Wikipedia has been a fantastic success story of kind of the things assembled by crowd, so to speak. But I have this feeling that sort of writing the great essay that shows up on Wikipedia is somehow a more generally kind of exciting activity than, I really like things of data, but I have a suspicion that that is more of a, the nerdiness quotient or something has to be higher or something. I proudly am in that, in that box, so to speak, but I think it's a more kind of, it's a more professional, judgment-intensive kind of activity, I think, because, you see, here's the point, when you see an essay in Wikipedia, the very texture of that essay sort of tells you what's going on. It tells you whether the person knows what they're talking about. It tells you, whether it just gives you some feeling for what's going on. Data is, in a sense, very cold. It's just 7.2. The number is 7.2. Doesn't come with attached to an essay. It's just 7.2. And, what you need, the kind of reliability that you need, and the kind of people who are going to make that number 7.2 as opposed to 7.8. There's a certain, I think there's a, you have to have a, at least my current view is that it's important to have a kind of a more, somewhat more controlled environment, because you don't get to know all of the footnotes, so to speak, immediately, as you do in kind of the essay type setting. So, right now, my best mechanism is you hire good data curators. We have all these tests for data curators. We hire good people. They have to have quite a bit of domain knowledge, otherwise they get things wrong. It's a somewhat more sort of organized and professionalized thing. Now, I'm certainly hoping that we will be able to provide the tools and the framework to have a very good community of volunteer and so on data curators out there who can potentially help with what we're doing, but we fully expect that what they're doing will have to sort of fit into this whole pipeline we've built, and sort of that we'll have to be doing our sort of data auditing processes and so on them. It doesn't feel like the kind of thing for which it's going to work to just say, okay, well, you know, everybody just put the beast you feel like in. In the media, I've already seen Wolfram Alpha referred to as a Google killer. Who are you trying to kill? Anybody with this?
I don't want to. It's not what I do.
I'm trying to kill Wikipedia, trying to kill reference librarians. The thing I like to do is I like to build stuff. Right? This is a thing that I want to build. I build stuff as a practical person. It has to sort of fit into the ecosystem, the world. It has to be able to support itself, things like that. I think that we certainly, if we look at Google and Wikipedia, these are both sort of great achievements, and they're both very complementary to what we're doing. I mean, Wikipedia we're dealing with the facts, just the facts. Wikipedia is dealing with kind of the narrative, and you might have noticed the sidebar to Wolfram Alpha often pulls up Wikipedia links with the rollovers that show sort of some little piece of narrative from Wikipedia. That I think is a terrific kind of synergy there, and maybe we'll get other kinds of encyclopedic and other kinds of narrative things that can sort of complement Wolfram Alpha. As far as search is concerned, sort of traditional web search, again, is a very complementary kind of thing. I mean, I use Wolfram Alpha lots. I also use, search engines and Google and so on lots. I use them for different kinds of things. I mean, I'll use Wolfram Alpha when I have some specific question that where I'm trying to compute something about, whereas I'll use, a search engine where I'm looking for some fragmentary piece of information that isn't systematic at all. It's just, Well, is there something about, David Weinberg that just happens to be out there that I can kind of pick up and read the narrative about it? I think that I'm a business idealist, okay? I've been lucky enough to have a successful business for 20-something years, that I've been able to sort of pursue with Mathematica and so on, something that I consider to be kind of intellectually, something of sort of high intellectual integrity that also can be a very pleasantly successful business. I certainly hope to do the same kind of thing with Wolf Malfa, and I think that I'm sort of hoping for the best possible synergy with folks who have complementary kinds of things. I mean, I hope we won't be killing anybody. I hope nobody will be trying to kill us, so to speak. I think we're doing something that I believe can lead to a lot of sort of positive progress in the world. I'm just keen to see that happen.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.